From coast to coast to coast and around the world, you are listening to Terra Informa.
It's not true that you have to use like small words to convey big emotions, but I don't know, this is unnecessarily obtruse. Like I feel like he was just enjoying the act of writing rather than thinking of the reader. I can't understand how this won a Governor General's Prize.
Tell us what you really think, Chris.
I'm Marcel Cosman, and that's just an inflammatory little preview of what we've got in store for you today. In just a moment, we'll bring you the final chapter in the Terra Informa Summer Book Club. So take 30 seconds right now to go grab your copy of Tim Lilburn's Kill Site and get ready to follow along. We'll also have Morgana Folkman in at the end of the show to discuss a children's classic we're all familiar with and very fond of, Alligator Pie by Dennis Lee. But first up, we're going over Tim Lilburn's Kill Site, one of Canada's best-known collections of eco-poetry. Let's turn it over to Trevor Chow Fraser to lead the discussion.
So welcome to the August edition of the Terra Informa Summer Book Club. This time we read a book of poetry. It's called Kill Site by Tim Lilburn. Who is Tim Lilburn? Well, he's one of Canada's foremost eco-poets, which means that probably a few hundred people read him. But we are among those lucky few. So Tim Lilburn was born in 1950 in Regina, Saskatchewan. And he describes himself as a Canadian male working class kind of person in his upbringing. He went on to do a BA in English at Campion College, which is a Jesuit college at the University of Regina. And he later actually became a member of the Jesuit order, and he was there for 9 years. But he didn't really start writing poetry until he was finishing up with the Jesuit thing. He moved back to Saskatchewan in 1990, and he wrote several books, culminating with the one that we're reading, Kill Site, in 2003. And it is the winner of the Governor's General Award for Poetry in that year. So we're going to delve into this book and try to understand what the heck we were reading.
Well said.
Well put. Yep.
But first, it is poetry, so we just want to read some of the stuff that sounds really great, which is, I assume, partly what poetry is supposed to be about. So starting with Chris Changian Phillips, regular Terra Informer, what did you select to read?
I have a couple lines from a poem called Great Ignorance. This is one of the many poems in the book that sort of refers to what it's like being under the ground, moving under the ground, feeling the earth under the ground. I'm going to jump around here to the bits that I like. The Senlac Sandhills, near the Alberta-Saskatchewan border, under the 4-inch winter coat of soil, in damp sand, under caribou moss, with turquoise, and that carefully built and uncodified light, a drawn man made with white stones who closes his salmon eyes under the ground, the stone under water weight of things, yes and no, passing over. His name is the small ground nest egg in his mouth. You let cities go out of your body, cities seen from the air, one from the front of the neck, one from the lower back. They leave cavities. You collect some wood and start a fire in one of the holes out of the wind. I fall asleep and someone puts the peppery tang of the aluminum slug of a mid-autumn snowfall between my upper lip and gums at the front of my mouth. And I'm ready, hunched flowingly toward the ground in a limp of sick long sleep.
Awesome. So what was it that drew you to those lines?
I like the imagery of, this person who isn't named, who has all these characteristics of sort of being part salmon and part egg and all these things. I like that he says his name is the small ground nest egg in his mouth. Like it's something unspeakable. I don't know. It kind of reminds me of the idea of like how people are always joking about like, oh, why'd you give your cat that name Tom? Because he probably picked a name like Maximus Terroticus, Destroyer of All, for himself. You know, like how we can't know that the things that we name things are accurate to the will of the thing itself, but I don't know. I just like that he didn't even try to give a human name to this under the ground person.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. How about next up, Tazbia Nishat? What do you want to read?
I have to admit, I didn't read that much, but I found that even if a lot of the things flew over my head, you can still appreciate the word choices. So I have a small bit from the namesake of the book, Kill Site. Only a song would turn the lock. He kept walking, wanting, and fearing the freezing of rivers. So I just really like the juxtaposition of like fear and wanting, and yeah, how like nature can be deadly, but like you like nature, but it can also kill you, that kind of thing. So that's, yeah, that's why I like that bit.
Okay, and also in the studio here is Yvette Thompson. What would you like to read?
I am going to read a little passage from A Gloss on To the River. I guess I'll just read you a few little bits and pieces just to kind of let you in on what's going on in my own head here. The only way in is impoverishment. Don't repeat this to anyone. Everything is poor, moving in a slow light from itself. Further in, a dark. This is home and song. The names of things are hidden and alone. It's very dark. It's very impressive. There's another part down here, too. He says, oh, yes, this is the one. There is a world next to the world, and Eros melts into it. It is the clear field with its light inside and would appear if the fixed word would come towards us out of the forest. Nothing is more than this. The word can be said to not exist. From desire, a garden would come. It's just such a philosophical muse on our relationship to nature. But I also think it's, after hearing about where Tim actually came from, I feel as though it's a lot of an internal conflict in the way that he perceives his position, maybe his plight through a religious take on the world and in studying religion, and then coming to be a renowned eco-poet. I think it speaks to how lost maybe he is, and I suppose that resonates with me because I consider myself to be very environmentally aware, but at the same time, I am still a person, so I still take an anthropological and anthropocentric view to the world. Mm-hmm.
Like it's funny too because you're pointing to how he has this inner conflict, and like it's a poem, which is a gloss on an entire book of poetry he already put out. Mm-hmm. So he's like, I put out this whole thing, and I still can't. Like, I don't know how I feel about it. So he writes a whole new poem.
Yeah, totally. Which,
I actually wanted to read from this poem, too. I really liked the end of it. With things, your virtue doesn't matter. None of this is for you. When you look into a distant thing as into a mirror, you will see something that will terrify you. Everything that is both erotic and does not care for you. It does not travel toward you, but it moves. Motionless, it moves. Everything is rag poor, light poor, it moves. When, because we are frank, buried, unlimited, widows, because nothing works, things come towards us. When the river enters us then, it feels a little like a low-grade fever. It feels a little like a low-grade fever. It feels as if we've just been missed by a car. Yeah. So the thing that really gets to me is just this relentless, like, edging towards something really dark, and then he like sums it all up by saying it feels a little feverish, it feels like I just like almost died. Mm-hmm. But here I am standing here, not dead, and like, what is that feeling like?
And you can almost feel the tension. Like, it is a very tense poem. So this is one where on paper, you know, you can kind of gloss over it, pardon the language there, but the poem itself is such a turbulent, sort of almost destructive piece that it is not just saying that he's kind of upset and not sure himself, but he's actually like ripping apart something that he's already done. So that's like taking a whole nother layer to this.
Yeah.
I think this book became a lot more comprehensible for me once I remembered that poems are often not a coherent story from beginning to end, too. Sometimes they're just like a meditation on a moment, or here is a feeling that I had that I'm trying to get across to you. A lot of them I feel like are just like a sketch of I'm trying to understand this dream that I had where I was in one place and then I was another, and this golden animal like shrugged past me. And
yeah.
Less like, I don't know, I feel like some of them you're just, maybe he's just trying to communicate, this was something that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, which, can we go there, Trevor? With how uncomfortable a lot of this book was.
Yeah, did it make you uncomfortable too?
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
It did. There were a couple moments over the course of this book where I actually just, couldn't really understand, first of all, what the heck he was trying to say. And then I was almost offended with his use of language, but maybe it wasn't so much his use of language, but the discomfort that I felt reading this and saying, I would never have said that, and you're taking me into a place where I'm not comfortable going, so I'm going to actually put it down. I'm going to say it. I'm going to say this line. Do you mind?
Go ahead.
And this is a line from, it's called The Book That Changes Everything. A fox below the ground does his calculations. Gold marks on a blue like someone saying, yes, 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 of course. That's it. A blue like seeing with the eye that sees you. The fox's quick, streaking mark smells like the vaginal fluids of white women. Or like pelicans moving low on the water, almost touching the water, almost night, July, the water green, not aware of itself, unlike itself, alert. Okay. Why did he have to say something about the vaginal fluids of white women? I just feel like it was so out of place. It was so uncomfortable. It made me not want to read it.
I had a moment where in the poem that I read a clip, a snippet from, Great Ignorance, he just has the line, I had a hard on, period. And I thought, it's sort of a non sequitur, and it made me think, like, am I overly uncomfortable with the sexuality of older people? But also, what?
Why?
How? What? How does this relate to anything going on in this book?
Yeah.
I think, like, there's a certain stream of consciousness aspect to the poetry where he seems to be just saying whatever is happening. And in part, that's a way I think he's trying to use that in order to describe authentically what he's seeing. But in order to do that, I guess he has to bring in everything that's happening inside him as well. And so random things that happen, which might be socially taboo, enter into the poetry anyways.
Okay, maybe that's also the source of the other biggest sticking point I had with this book, which is that every single poem required me to Google at least 3 or 4 times the names of obscure 5th century Christian mystics. I don't think that I needed, like, I think my life would have been okay if I hadn't known who John Cassian is, as well as Nicholas of Cusa, and like, I get, okay, he's referencing an idea of, like, I am sailing out from the idea of this desert mystic from Egypt in the 5th century. Okay, interesting, but, like, is it necessary to keep referencing a new one every poem? Like, if you're trying to use a shared language, create a shared language that we can all live in for this whole f***ing book.
Yeah, it's so true. But again, I think understanding where he came from gives me a little bit more insight to that. But nonetheless, like, yeah, I felt purely dumb reading part of this poetry, because I would be reading through and just trying to understand exactly where he was coming from, and then all of a sudden one of those ridiculous references came in that required me to think that I had to know it, but I really didn't have to know it.
Basically unreadable without Google.
Is that how you felt as well? Did you have difficulty reading it?
Yeah, I feel like it'd be better if you could just read it without having to dissect and analyze. I felt like I was in, like, English class again.
Yeah, actually, one of the funny things is we chose a book of poetry because it was short, but I took so much more time reading this because, like, I would read just through just to see what happened, and then I'd go back and try to pay attention to things and see what jumped out at me, get a laptop and Google things. It took me, like, several weeks, but the more that you know about Tim Lilburn and the more you know about the rest of the book, the more each little reference can kind of open up.
You are listening to Terra Informa on your local community radio station. Every week, we bring you environmental news and stories collected from across Canada. Today, it's the Terra Informa Summer Book Club, where we are discussing Tim Lilburn's collection of poems, Killsite.
I should mention that my partner is a scholar of Canadian literature, and she studied a lot of Canadian poetry, and she actually told me that if you're not uncomfortable, then you're doing it wrong. So all of this discomfort is very important.
Yeah.
I did want to try and get into some of these ideas in the book that maybe are making us uncomfortable. The one thing that really jumped out at me first and that I was trying to wrestle with was this idea of walking underground. It starts off with Henry Kelsey.
Also known as Boy Kelsey, so says Wikipedia.
Yeah, who is walking underground. He dies or goes away, but continues walking, and he slowly, slowly moves further and further underground until it's just his voice. And also throughout the poem, it's the narrator who is moving underground. And so partly, it seems like he's literally saying that he's moving underground. I don't know. How did you guys make sense of that?
Well, I did get the underground reference, like not as much that he was moving underground, but like maybe just kind of going back to like your primal self, which is kind of what like going out to nature really is. What I found interesting was it's like I read this article that talked about how children are kind of they're kind of like bombarded with all these animalistic images, like for example, animal crackers, anthropomorphized animal characters in television cartoons and such. So that was kind of like them going back into nature their own way because we're so separated from it anyway. This is kind of like more of an adult take on it, more dark adult take on going back into nature. Yeah.
It's actually interesting that this theme comes up again, as in not necessarily the going underground, but going back into nature, because this is actually reminding me really, really quite intensely of our conversation about being caribou that we did back in June. And that was all about returning to nature, like literally going to follow the caribou herd. So,
and what would it be like, I think, maybe his question in some of the poems too. Like there's one called The House where he's not talking about a person underground, but the first line is, "The house, finally, is under topsoil and stones, lit with mind light, low talk, the given looks of animals." And then he's describing what it might be like to have this house under the ground with, like, owl dusk wings and its blood and boxes and, you know, a house that wants to hibernate and stuff. So I don't know, maybe part of it is he's just trying to picture what it would be like to be part of a landscape again. Now that I'm talking about this out loud, I realize that what I got from being caribou was like the frame of reference for why that was interesting to explore. Like, okay, this society is like this. We are removed from our connection with the rest of nature in these ways. And so this is how we sought reconnection. I don't get that sense from Tim Lilburn's book here, Killsite, of why he's searching for that connection.
Yeah, I think the part of the context for me that was striking as the figure he chooses for this walking underground, like going back to nature, is Henry Kelsey, who's a colonial figure. Like, he worked for the Hudson's Bay Company. He was supposed to be the quote-unquote first white man to see the West. So if he's choosing someone, if he wants himself to go back to nature, why would he choose someone who represents like the total subjugation of the land and like the erasure of all these native cultures and all of these wild beings? Like, does Henry Kelsey represent the flourishing of colonialism, that he's completely taken over the land, that his voice is heard everywhere, he's completely one with the land? And if so, is Tim Lilburn saying that's what he wants to do? It doesn't seem like that's what he wants to do. The poem that spoke the most to me was "Nothing Should Be Said About This," which is the third last poem. And to me, it just reads as this rush of senses, sensory kind of experiences. There's sight and touch and scent, and he just kind of moves through the land, just riffing off things that he sees. And at the very end, it says, "There is no hatred of philosophy here. Stand by the bluish mud along the shore, and a new sort of citizenship comes up, lashing its blinding tail." So to me, like, the new sort of citizenship suggests that he has found some way to belong to the land. And it's through this kind of stream of consciousness, just kind of seeing what's there and just not trying to conceptualize it too much. But it's also citizenship that has this lashing, blinding tail. So it suggests that it's not very easy what he's trying to do. It might be a bit painful.
Well, I mean, maybe it's a... Okay, so there's something that I thought about when I was reading this book, is that John Livingston, environmental philosopher from Toronto, said that basically Western society is probably unavoidably headed towards collapse, because the only way to really, like, solve our ecological crises is to have an intimate emotional relationship with something wild. And wilderness, I think I'm getting the sense that, like, from, like, what I'm reading in life and experiencing, that wilderness is really, like, knowing that things have a will of their own that's not something comprehensible completely. Like the last poem, "Now Lifted Now," he talks about 3 years ago when the gold animal appeared to me. It walked out of the robes of its custom, and it bent and took my smell, and then it, like, crawls out, you know, in its own direction. And so maybe, like, this, like, process of trying to understand, like, what is wilderness? What are humans in wilderness? What does it mean to be wild? Is, like, a process destined for heartbreak, because, like, the best you can do is understand that big world out there that he's describing is something that it doesn't have you at the top of its mind. It's got its own concerns, and they're not, you know, necessarily something even relatable.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally right.
Yeah.
Like, it's that when you encounter an animal in Tim Lilburn's poetry, like, the animal is just there, and, like, there's no seeing a deeper meaning in the animal. It's this weird, bizarre thing that gives him hard-ons sometimes.
This is going to be a really interesting juxtaposition with our children's book for the month.
Ooh.
Yes. Well, maybe we should get on to that. I would say that Killside is a staggeringly beautiful work, if you're ready for it. So, Yvette, Chris, and Tasmia, thank you for reading along with me, even though none of us were ready for it. And in just a moment, we're going to have Morgana Folkman in here to talk about alligator pie.
Hey, everyone. So on this week on our children's segment of Book Club, we have some comfort food, a Canadian classic that many of you may know, alligator pie. Okay, so I'd never read alligator pie as a kid. I read another one of Dennis Lee's excellent poetry books, Jelly Belly, which I recommend to everyone.
Jelly Belly.
You like Jelly Belly?
I didn't know that was him.
Me either. I just found out on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I had that book as a kid.
Yeah, it's great. Terrifying illustrations, mm-hmm. But we'll get to that. So when I read it, first when you're an adult reading a kid's book you've never read before, you're really in an adult headspace where the words don't make sense, where, like, what he's actually meaning to say, and then you relax a little bit. And you imagine a kid taking in these images and laughing at the way willoughby wallaby woo sounds, or the fact that a shark is supposed to be barking, or how silly it would be for an elephant to sit on someone, though maybe not actually funny, but to a kid. So one thing he talks about, and I want to kind of tie into your discussion of Killsite, So when Lee began writing for children, part of his goal was to reclaim language and liberate imagination. He, quote, tries to free Canadian children from a colonial mentality by creating poems rooted in the words and activities of their everyday lives, poems which encourage free imaginative play. And throughout the book, every poem talks about animals and nature and eating and smelling and just the senses. And his goal was to really move away from Mother Goose, which talks about things that are really outside of children's reality.
That reminds me of something. Yeah, do you know the Nigerian author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie? She talks about how when she was growing up in Nigeria, it didn't occur to her as a kid that it was strange that she was reading books about apples in winter until she was an adult. And she was like, wait, I've never seen snow. Why are all my books about snow?
I should say something about the pictures as well. The book is illustrated by Frank Neufeld, and they're quite vivid images, very colorful, very surreal. And actually, like, as an adult, I'm like, these are actually kind of scary and a little bit creepy. And as, you know, I would think kids would be frightened by them, like in the poem
Billy Batter.
Like the poem Billy Batter, that has a dragon and a monster running off with Billy's parents. And, you know, the beautifully colored, horrifying dragon and monster are making direct eye contact with the reader and baring their teeth. But at the same time, there'd be something like totally ludicrous to a child about their mom or dad, who's like their big, strong protector, being carried away weeping, like with big tears and like a baby. So I, like, the more I thought about it, the more I'd be like, no, a kid would laugh at that. Yeah.
Should we read it?
Let's read Billy Batter.
Billy Batter, what's the matter? How come you're so sad? I lost my cat in the laundromat, and a dragon ran off with my dad. My dad! A dragon ran off with my dad. Billy Batter, what's the matter? How come you're so glum? I ripped my jeans in the Coke machine, and a monster ran off with my mum. My mum! A monster ran off with my mum. These are songs. This is meant to be so. Billy Batter, now you're better, happy as a tack. The dragon's gone to Saskatchewan. The monster fell in a wishing well. The cat showed up with a newborn pup. I fixed the rips with potato chips, and my dad and my mum came back. Came back. My dad and my mom came back. That's deliciously surreal.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading this, like, as an adult. It was kind of interesting getting into the mindset of a kid, like, how a kid would appreciate that and remembering how I thought like that. And it was fun.
Well, that was Morgana Folkman wrapping up the children's portion of today's book club. And that was the final book club of the summer. I don't know if we're going to keep doing this. Should we? Let us know. Tell us on Twitter at Terra Informa or email us, terra@cjsr.com, and let us know if you want more book club episodes throughout the year. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Thank you for listening. Thanks also to this week's contributors, Trevor Chow Fraser, Yvette Thompson, Tasmia Nishat, Chris Chang-Yan Phillips, and Morgana Folkman. Trevor also took care of production and the website. Terra Informa is produced in studio at CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton. I've been your host, Marcel Cosman. Tune in again next week.